I will, by way of setting up the program today, simply quote the President of these United States. Crazy inverted yield curve! All caps, of course, exclamation point included. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 14th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We will get to the president in a minute and the proximate cause of that tweet that I quoted. But look, first thing you ought to do right now, and really should have done right from the opening bell today, is take a deep, deep breath. Because markets go down too, gang. Just like over time, they mostly go up. But I digress, because what got the president tweeting and stocks cratering today was something we have talked about before on this program, the bond market. Specifically, something called the yield curve, which normally curves up and to the right the longer-term bond you are talking about. That is to say, the interest rate, the yield that the government has to pay to borrow your money for, say, 10 years, is usually more than the government has to pay if you buy, say, a two-year Treasury note. Makes sense, right? They are tying up your money for longer. Today, that yield curve, remember, usually up and to the right, inverted. The 10-year yield was, for a little while this morning, less than the 2-year yield. Now, we should care about that because why, Kai? Well, we called Kathy Jones at Charles Schwab, which is, we should say, an underwriter of this program. Here she is.
And when that happens, it signals that expectations for the future are not as optimistic as current conditions.
Expectations that the strong economy we are enjoying right now might not last. Why, though, did the bottom pretty much drop out of stocks today? Here's Sam Stovall at CFRA Research.
Well, I think investors are worried because every recession since the 1970s has been preceded by an inverted yield curve.
However,
yet, like Logic 101 in college, not every inverted yield curve has led to recessions.
More to the point, a recession is not starting, like, tomorrow.
On average, an inverted yield curve has occurred 11 months before the beginning of recessions since 1960.
Case in point, the Great Recession, which officially started in December 2007, the yield curve first inverted in December 2005. So, deep breath. But there is something else going on here, too. There are some things going on in the economy today that are just different than they used to be. One good example is something called the Phillips curve, which for decades has said that the lower unemployment gets, like it is right now, really low, the more inflation there will be, which just has not been happening. In fact, last month, Fed Chair Jay Powell said basically, yeah, forget the Phillips curve.
The relationship between slack in the economy or unemployment and inflation was a strong one 50 years ago. If you remember, in the 60s, there was a close correlation there, and that has gone away.
So from the Marketplace desk of Take a Deep, Deep Breath, Justin Ho set himself to finding out whether the yield curve's predictive power might be up there with the Phillips curve.
There are a couple of reasons why the yield curve might be inverting that have nothing to do with a recession. One is that the Fed owns a ton of bonds that it bought up to stimulate the economy after the crisis. That caused prices to rise and yields to drop. A report today from Wells Fargo said if the Fed didn't own all those bonds, the yield curve probably wouldn't have inverted. And so, says Drew Mattis at MetLife Investment Management,
you know, it's not clear that the yield curve is actually giving a signal of recession at this point.
The other reason has to do with inflation. Longer-term bonds usually pay more than shorter-term bonds because they try to account for inflation. Ben Carlson at Ritholtz Wealth Management says it's kind of like a buffer in case prices rise while an investor's holding a bond for a decade or longer.
And now that buffer is sort of gone.
That's because inflation isn't behaving the way it should either.
The economy's booming. Unemployment is sort of at a 25-year low.
Kenneth Rogoff is an economist at Harvard.
That's the definition of when you expect to start to see wages pushing up, that's spilling into inflation.
But it's not. Rogoff says the real mystery right now is why.
It's remarkable. I don't know of anyone who really pretends to understand this.
Even former Fed Chair Janet Yellen weighed in on the inverted yield curve today. She told Fox Business that this time it's not a great signal of a coming recession. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, step away from your 401k statement, people. Seriously, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The marketplace company of the day today is the We Company, better known for its co-working space, WeWork. They filed their first detailed financial statements ahead of their upcoming initial public offering expected as soon as next month. Not great were the numbers. Revenues of about $1.5 billion, losses of $900 million for the first 6 months of the year. Why, yes, that is another in a long line of IPOs of companies with no profits but lots of upside potential. Think Uber and Lyft, if things break the right way for them. But about that, the if. One big risk factor the company pointed out, recession. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
With more than 700 locations around the world, WeWork makes money by leasing office space from landlords, turning that space into an Instagrammer's dream, adding perks like kombucha on tap, and then renting out workspaces to people like Sarah Schott, a nonprofit consultant in Seattle.
I sort of felt like my membership was being paid for in free nitro cold brew. The environment is slick and visually interesting.
The tastefully appointed offices are stuffed with freelancers, startups, and small businesses, but there's risk in that.
A co-working space is a splurge for people, and when your business is hit, you've got to make decisions to cover your cost.
Lauren Lemunyan is a professional coach in Washington, D.C., who's worked out of several different co-working spaces. She says she'd probably just go back to coffee shops if business took a hit. The short-term nature of most WeWork memberships could be a problem because the buildings it has to rent have long-term leases, says Kathleen Smith with Renaissance Capital.
They're average 15 years, so there's a mismatch between their costs and their revenue.
WeWork is now attracting more big corporations like Microsoft because they tend to stay longer.
Then what that's done is double the average length of their membership commitment.
Alexander Snyder with Center Square Investment Management says big companies now make up 40% of WeWork's membership. That part of the business could have more potential for growth, even or especially in a recession, says April Rinney, a business consultant on the future of work.
Depending on who you are, WeWork offers cost savings and cost benefits compared to having to own and operate everything yourself.
In recessions, that can be pretty attractive to corporations looking to save money. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
The first startup from Africa to list on the New York Stock Exchange was an e-commerce company called Jumia. It has been called, in fact, the Amazon of Africa, but Jumia does face one big challenge that Amazon doesn't, trying to find a street address in a largely cash-based economy. Danielle Paquette wrote about Jumia. She's the West Africa Bureau Chief for the Washington Post. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
So there you are driving around with an e-commerce delivery driver in Abidjan, Ivory Coast. What's that like?
It was chaotic. You know, I really wanted to see what it was like delivering packages where numbered addresses are rare. You know, how are people finding each other? How difficult might that be? I know that I'm really reliant on GPS, but I've realized that you can't always rely on those tools that we take for granted.
So this driver you were with, Vivian Lakpa, I guess was her name. She kind of rolled with the punches, as it were, right? And just said, look, this is the future. I want to be part of it.
Yeah, I was really impressed. So she's sitting in the front seat and she's working with a seasoned taxi driver. And she gets a list of customer names and approximate locations and phone numbers and just invites me into the back seat, squished between these packages, and off we roll into the city. And she's just on the phone like, hello, this is Jumia. Where are you? Hello, this is Jumia. Do you remember ordering this? Wow. You know, all day long.
And they get there with the deliveries and the people want to test out the product, right? Tell me about the guy with the tea kettle it was, right?
Right. Now, that was very surprising to me. You know, I wasn't really sure what was going on. We arrive after two failed attempts to find this office. Finally, we get to the right place. And the boss instructs his assistant to open this package. You know, they pull out a kettle, fill it up with water, and then they plug it into the wall because they want to make sure that it works before handing over a single dollar.
So tell me then about this company that is behind this, because honestly, it does not seem like a winning proposition right now. You know, eventually it's going to grow and e-commerce is going to be great in Africa. But right now, Jumia is having some problems.
Well, everyone sees this market as this giant investment opportunity. There are more people in Africa with internet access than there are people in the United States. Mm. It's just a matter of reaching them. Jumia is the biggest digital marketplace on the continent. They have about 4 million active users in 14 different countries. And everything is kind of in pilot mode, you know. Mm. This particular arrangement of the driver and someone helping them is relatively new, to see if they can slowly and manually build up this database of addresses.
Wow. How long till Jeff Bezos and Amazon just come in and buy Jumia and they steamroll the whole thing and do it that way?
I don't think anyone wants to see that happen. Yeah. People are calling for African solutions to these African challenges. So you have entrepreneurs on the ground trying to figure out how to fix these, you know, pretty basic infrastructure and cultural problems so they can access this exploding market.
Danielle Paquette, she's the West Africa Bureau Chief from the Washington Post, writing about e-commerce over there and the challenges it faces. Danielle, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
And I said, what is this? Is this a working day?
When the biggest company in town shuts down. But first, just because we have to, let's do the numbers. Well, Dow Industrials plunged 800 points, 3%, 25,479, the worst percentage drop for the Dow this year. The NASDAQ tanked 242 points, 3%, 77.73. The S&P 500 down 85 points, 2.9%, 28.40 there. As we explained, that inverted yield curve has been, until now anyway, a reliable early-ish indicator of a coming recession. Citigroup down 5.2%. Today, J.P. Morgan Chase down 4.1%. Bank of America off 4.6%. Yield curve notwithstanding, Macy's plunged more than 13% this Wednesday after the retailer missed expectations for its fiscal second quarter. Nordstrom down 10.6%. Kohl's sank 10.9% today. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note, just because we mentioned it earlier, down to 1.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. You know what happens when interest rates, as we have been telling you for, I don't know, like a week or two now, take a digger like they've been doing? Well, a lot of things happen. But one of those things is that there's a mortgage refinancing boom. The Mortgage Bankers Association said today that refi applications were up 37% last week as the average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage hit a nearly four-year low of 3.93%. Of course, to refinance, you got to have a pretty good credit score. It's a good FICO score, to be precise. FICO has been the go-to for decades. But some competition may be coming to the mortgage market. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac don't make loans directly, but they buy or guarantee about half the mortgages made by lenders. So what they say kind of goes.
Basically, if you want what's called a conventional mortgage, you have to be eligible under the Fannie or Freddie criteria.
And Chi-Chi Wu with the National Consumer Law Center says for decades, those criteria have included a FICO score. But under new rules from their regulator, Fannie and Freddie will have to consider using alternative scoring models, like the one from VantageScore. It's a joint venture of the three credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. Managing Director Philip Bracken estimates its model can score 40 million people who don't have enough of a credit history to get a FICO score.
There would be a reasonably good share of them that would be mortgage eligible after we were able to provide them a credit score.
That's because, for one thing, VantageScore looks at older credit data that FICO considers less reliable. FICO's Joanne Gaskin says if you look at VantageScores for people without a FICO,
more than two-thirds of them get a score below 620, which would effectively lock them out of the prime market.
To really make the system more inclusive, consumer advocates say credit scores should include more factors like on-time rent and utility payments. The rule change does allow Fannie and Freddie to approve pilot programs that consider other measures of credit worthiness. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Tracy Samuelson did a story last week about the General Motors plant in Lordstown, Ohio, and what it being taken offline as GM moves from less profitable sedans to more popular trucks and SUVs, what that would mean for the people who work there. One of the other plants, there are five in total that GM is putting in mothballs, is Detroit-Hamtramck Assembly. It's right on the border between the two cities and, as it happens, a relative stone's throw from GM headquarters. Both cities have been through the shutdown thing before. This plant is the second one on that spot to close. The first time, back in the late 1970s, locals did what they could to adjust. Here's Tracy one more time.
The Dodge brothers produced their first passenger car in Hamtramck in 1914, just before the beginning of World War I. By the end of World War II, the plant employed 36,000 auto workers. But in the late 70s, the sedans and station wagons it produced couldn't compete with smaller Japanese imports. And Chrysler, which owned Dodge, shuttered the plant in 1980.
When the plant closed, we didn't know what the heck we were going to do. How do we replace that?
Greg Kowalski was the editor of the Hamtramck Citizen newspaper at the time. He now runs the Hamtramck Historical Museum. Not only was Hamtramck suddenly without its biggest employer, taxes from the plant provided about a quarter of the city's operating revenue.
While we were looking at options, this plan was put forward by General Motors and by the city of Detroit.
GM would build a new high-tech factory, one it said could employ as many as 6,000 people. The cities of Detroit and Hamtramck strung together over $300 million in tax incentives. They offered GM the site of the old Dodge plant, plus 465 acres next to it, a little less than 1 square mile. The plant had a lot of support from the area's big players, politicians, the auto workers union, local newspapers, even the Catholic Archdiocese. Problem was, that land wasn't empty. It was most of a neighborhood called Poletown, a densely packed working-class area named for the Polish immigrants who came to work in the Dodge plant. 3,500 residents, 1,500 homes, 144 businesses, 16 churches, and a hospital would all have to go. Some Poletown residents were eager to have the city buy them out and make a fresh start somewhere else, but other residents didn't want to go.
Many of the 3,500 people who would be displaced have banded together to fight GM in court, arguing that the city has no right to condemn private property for the private use of a corporation. They accuse the city of sacrificing people to get taxes the plant would pay.
Some families had lived in the same houses and worshipped in the same churches their whole lives. They resented the idea of being pushed out for the benefit of a big company.
For angry residents, the question now is whether the corporation GM has more rights than they do. But the basic issue which has divided this community is whether the cost of progress will be worth the price.
Detroit Mayor Coleman Young defended the plan on CBS News in 1981.
When you have to strike a balance, you have to strike the balance in favor of life and jobs, as opposed to the slow death.
It was a wild time, says historian Greg Kowalski.
I mean, there were protests, there were marches, and they were tearing down Immaculate Conception Church, and people were chaining themselves to the gates and all this kind of stuff.
A group of Poletown residents sued the city, challenging its use of eminent domain, and they took the case all the way to the Michigan Supreme Court. Judge James Ryan is one of two surviving Michigan Supreme Court justices who ruled on the Poletown case. He understood why the cities were so eager to support GM.
be. The unemployed will go to work. The economy will be boosted. Collateral satellite businesses will be established. It's hard to be against that.
But Judge Ryan didn't think it was legal.
The Constitution says you can take property for use, public use. Fire station, police station.
This was something different. No matter how many jobs the plant might create, the judge thought doing something for the public's benefit wasn't the same as doing it for public use. But Judge Ryan was in the minority. The court ruled to let the GM plant go ahead.
The official end of a year's battle came at daybreak today. Detroit police bursting through the doors behind the main altar, dragging to jail 12 final holdouts who'd vowed to stand by their church to the end.
Make a right, then make a left. Oh, seatbelt.
Tom Olachowski was one of the leaders of the Poletown resistance and still lives in the area. He showed me around what's left of the neighborhood on a rainy summer day.
So as we're driving, can you describe the area as it looks now and what it would have looked like before?
Oh, it's a wreck now. It's a ruin now. It's fields. There's maybe 10 houses here that are livable and functioning. You know, and I'm talking an area of maybe a mile long, right? You've got maybe a dozen places here that are functioning well. Other than that, it's mostly ruins and fields now.
We drive through an intersection where, on every corner, it's just open lots with waist-high grasses. In Tom's mind, GM did this. Swallowed up most of Poletown and sucked the livelihood out of the parts that remain. There are others who say that Poletown was dying even before GM, that its housing stock and infrastructure were run down, that GM's jobs and taxes propped up Hamtramck and the surrounding area after Dodge pulled out, that the sacrifice was worth it. But about those jobs. After the plant was built, Judge James Ryan remembers visiting a friend in his brand new office in one of Detroit's highest skyscrapers. From 25 stories up, he looked east and saw a big, empty parking lot.
I said, what's that over there? Is that the Poletown plant? And he said, yeah, it's the General Motors plant. And I said, what is this? Is this a working day? And Joe said, yeah. And I said, well, I don't understand where all the employees are.
Instead of 6,000 jobs, the Poletown plant opened with 3,000.
Which triggered in my mind the memory that the lawyers argued vigorously that this was a public benefit because of the great number of workers who would be employed. Well, it didn't turn out that way.
Today, only about 800 people work in the plant, and they'll be out of a job or will have to transfer elsewhere if GM follows through with its plans to idle the plant next year. That leaves Detroit and Hamtramck in a familiar place. Again, looking for something to replace a giant automaker. Again, worried about what will happen if something doesn't. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Tommy Andres helped produce that story for us. We've got more about Poletown and Hamtramck at marketplace.org. September, as in next month, is going to be the 21st anniversary of the U.S. release of the first book in the Harry Potter series. And all these years later, those books still show up in our culture in sometimes unexpected ways. Harry Potter-themed cafes, yes, wizard camps, a semi-pro Quidditch league. Also, today's installment of our occasional series highlighting creative out-of-office email responses we've seen. It's called Automatic Reply.
Dear witches, wizards, and other magical folk, first, let me say how much I admire your efforts to master muggle forms of communication. Second, I regret to inform you that I am unable to reply to your Echotronic mail. I will be away through Monday performing my headmistress duties at Hogwarts Preparatory Academy. Please send an owl instead. If your matter is urgent and you absolutely must receive an Echotronic reply, please contact our Muggle Relations Officer, Robin. I want to reassure you that Muggles who attempt to contact me at this address will receive a completely different response than you have. They will be told that I am away receiving something called a root canal. I don't know what that is, but I gather that it is unpleasant enough to discourage further inquiry. Thank you. Kelly Cowling, headmistress of Hogwarts Preparatory Academy, Order of Merlin, First Class.
Kelly Cowling is the executive director in real life, this is, of Greyhaven's Philosophy. It's a community nonprofit in Longmont, Colorado. Tell us about an out-of-office message you've seen, would you? You can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, about which I honestly know not what to make, but which I will leave here for your use. Amazon, as you may know, is working on facial recognition software. Lots of things troubling about that. Of course, privacy concerns, misuse by governments and companies, profiling issues as well. But given today on Wall Street, I thought it was apt to point this out. Amazon said this week that it's improved its accuracy for emotion detection. Happy, sad, angry, all the usual ones. Also, fear. All right, we got to go. Look, I'm going to give you these numbers, but please, deep breath. Take one. Dow Industrials, 800 points to the downside today, 3%. The NASDAQ off 242 points, 3% there. S&P 500 lost 85 points, 2.9%. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.